say he was happy with joy at the news that a battle group from Oslo had reached the city. He could at last turn his attention back to the west. On May 1st, he ordered that preparations for the big attack there be ready by May 5th. The Wehrmacht commanders, Göring, Brauchitsch, Halder, Keitel, Jodl, Raeder, and the rest, had for the first time had a foretaste during the Norwegian campaign of how their demonic leader cracked under the strain of even minor setbacks in battle. It was a weakness which would grow on him when, after a series of further astonishing military successes, the tide of war changed, and it would contribute mightily to the eventual debacle of the Third Reich. Still, any way one looked at it, the quick conquest of Denmark and Norway had been an important victory for Hitler and a discouraging defeat for the British. It secured the winter iron ore route, gave added protection to the entrance to the Baltic, allowed the daring German navy to break out into the North Atlantic, and provided them with excellent port facilities there for submarines and surface ships in the sea war against Britain. It brought Hitler air bases hundreds of miles closer to the main enemy. And perhaps most important of all, it immensely enhanced the military prestige of the Third Reich and correspondingly diminished that of the Western Allies. Nazi Germany seemed invincible. Austria, Czechoslovakia, Poland, and now Denmark and Norway had succumbed easily to Hitler's force, or threat of force, and not even the help of two major allies in the West had been, in the latter cases, of the slightest avail. The wave of the future, as an eminent American woman wrote, seemed to belong to Hitler and Nazism. For the remaining neutral states, Hitler's latest conquest was also a terrifying lesson. Obviously, neutrality no longer offered protection to the little democratic nations trying to survive in a totalitarian-dominated world. Finland had just found that out, and now Norway and Denmark. They had themselves to blame for being so blind, for declining to accept in good time, before the actual aggression, the help of friendly world powers. "I trust this fact," Churchill told Commons on April 11th, "will be meditated upon by other countries who may tomorrow, or a week hence, or a month hence, find themselves the victims of an equally elaborately worked-out staff plan for their destruction and enslavement." He was obviously thinking of Holland and Belgium, but even in their case, though there would be a month of grace, no such meditation began. The Swedes, caught between Russia in Finland and the Baltic countries, and Germany in possession of adjoining Denmark and Norway, meditated and decided there was no choice except to cling to their precarious neutrality and go down fighting if they were attacked. They had placated the Soviet Union by refusing to allow Allied troops transit to Finland, and now under great pressure they placated Germany. Though Sweden had sent an impressive stock of arms to Finland, it refused to sell Norway either arms or gasoline when it was attacked. All through April, the Germans demanded that Sweden allow the transit of troops to Narvik to relieve Dietl, but this was refused until the end of hostilities, although a train of medical personnel and supplies was allowed through. On June 19th, fearing a direct attack by Germany, Sweden gave in to Hitler's pressure and agreed to permit the transport over Swedish railways of Nazi troops and war material to Norway, on condition that the number of troops moving in each direction should balance, so that the German garrisons in Norway would not be strengthened by the arrangement. This was of immense help to Germany. By transporting fresh troops and war material by land through Sweden, Hitler avoided the risk of having them sunk at sea by the British. In the first 6 months of the accord, some 140,000 German troops in Norway were exchanged, and the German forces there greatly strengthened by supplies. Later, just before the German onslaught on Russia, Sweden permitted the Nazi High Command to transport an entire army division, fully armed, from Norway across Sweden to Finland, to be used to attack the Soviet Union. What it had refused the Allies the year before, it accorded to Nazi Germany. For details of German pressure on Sweden, and for the text of the exchange of letters between King Gustav V and Hitler, see Documents on German Foreign Policy, Volume 9. The author has covered the subject more thoroughly in The Challenge of Scandinavia. There were military lessons, too, to be learned from Hitler's lightning conquest of the two Scandinavian countries. The most significant was the importance of air power and its superiority over naval power when land bases for bombers and fighters were near. Hardly less important was an old lesson, that victory often goes to the daring and the imaginative. The German Navy and Air Force had been both, and Dietl at Narvik had shown a resourcefulness of the German Army which the Allies had lacked. There was one military result of the Scandinavian adventure which could not be evaluated at once, if only because it was not possible to look very far into the future. The losses in men in Norway on both sides were light. The Germans suffered 1,317 killed, 2,375 missing and 1,604 wounded, a total of 5,296 casualties. Those of the Norwegians, French, and British were slightly less than 5,000. The British lost one aircraft carrier, one cruiser, and seven destroyers, and the Poles and the French one destroyer each. German naval losses were comparably much heavier, 10 out of 20 destroyers, 3 of 8 cruisers, while the battlecruisers Scharnhorst and Gneisenau and the pocket battleship Lützow were damaged so severely that they were out of action for several months. Hitler had no fleet worthy of mention for the coming events of the summer, when the time to invade Britain came as it did so shortly. This proved to be an insurmountable handicap. The possible consequences of the severe crippling of the German Navy, however, did not enter the Führer's thoughts as, at the beginning of May, with Denmark and Norway now added to his long list of conquests, he worked with his eager generals, for they had now shed their misgivings of the previous autumn, on the last-minute preparations for what they were confident would be the greatest conquest of all. Chapter 21. Victory in the West. Shortly after dawn, on the fine spring day of May 10, 1940, the ambassador of Belgium and the minister of the Netherlands in Berlin were summoned to the Wilhelmstrasse and informed by Ribbentrop that German troops were entering their countries to safeguard their neutrality against an imminent attack by the Anglo-French armies. The same shabby excuse that had been made just a month before with Denmark and Norway. A formal German ultimatum called upon the two governments to see to it that no resistance was offered. If it were, it would be crushed by all means, and the responsibility for the bloodshed would be borne exclusively by the Royal Belgian and the Royal Netherlands government. In Brussels and The Hague, as previously in Copenhagen and Oslo, the German envoys made their way to the respective foreign offices with similar messages. Ironically enough, the bearer of the ultimatum in The Hague was Count Julius von Zeck Burkersroda, the German minister, who was a son-in-law of Bethmann Hollweg, the Kaiser's chancellor, who in 1914 had publicly called Germany's guarantee of Belgian neutrality, which the Hohenzollern Reich had just violated, a scrap of paper. At the Foreign Ministry in Brussels, while German bombers roared overhead and the explosion of their bombs on nearby airfields rattled the windows, Bülow Schwante, the German ambassador, started to take a paper from his pocket as he entered the Foreign Minister's office. Paul-Henri Spaak stopped him. "I beg your pardon, Mr. Ambassador, I will speak first." "The German army," Spaak said, not attempting to hold back his feeling of outrage, "has just attacked our country. This is the second time in 25 years that Germany has committed a criminal aggression against a neutral and loyal Belgium. What has happened is perhaps even more odious than the aggression of 1914. No ultimatum, no note, no protest of any kind has ever been placed before the Belgian government. It is through the attack itself that Belgium has learned that Germany has violated the undertakings given by her. The German Reich will be held responsible by history. Belgium is resolved to defend herself." The unhappy German diplomat then began to read the formal German ultimatum, but Spaak cut him short. "Hand me the document," he said. "I should like to spare you so painful a task." The Third Reich had given the two small Low Countries guarantees of their neutrality almost without number. The independence and neutrality of Belgium had been guaranteed perpetually by the five great European powers in 1839, a pact that was observed for 75 years until Germany broke it in 1914. The Weimar Republic had promised never to take up arms against Belgium, and Hitler, after he came to power, continually reaffirmed that policy and gave similar assurances to the Netherlands. On January 30, 1937, after he had repudiated the Locarno Treaty, the Nazi chancellor publicly proclaimed, "The German government has further given the assurance to Belgium and Holland that it is prepared to recognize and to guarantee, the inviolability and neutrality of these territories. Frightened by the remilitarization of the Third Reich and its reoccupation of the Rhineland in the spring of 1936, Belgium, which wisely had abandoned neutrality after 1918, again sought refuge in it. On April 24, 1937, Britain and France released her from the obligations of Locarno, and on October 13th of that year, Germany officially and solemnly confirmed its determination that in no circumstances will it impair the inviolability and integrity of Belgium, and that it will at all times respect Belgian territory and be prepared to assist Belgium should she be subjected to an attack. From that day on, there is a familiar counterpoint in Hitler's solemn public assurances to the Low Countries and his private admonitions to his generals. On August 24, 1938, in regard to one of the papers drawn up for him for Case Green, the plan for the attack on Czechoslovakia, he spoke of the extraordinary advantage to Germany if Belgium and Holland were occupied, and asked the army's opinion as to the conditions under which an occupation of this area could be carried out, and how long it would take. On April 28, 1939, in his reply to Roosevelt, Hitler again stressed the binding declarations which he had given to the Netherlands and Belgium, among others. Less than a month later, on May 23, the Führer, as has been noted, was telling his generals that the Dutch and Belgian air bases must be occupied by armed force, with lightning speed. Declarations of neutrality must be ignored. He had not yet started his war, but his plans were ready. On August 22nd, a week before he launched the war by attacking Poland, he conferred with his generals about the possibility of violating Dutch and Belgian neutrality. England and France, he said, will not violate the neutrality of these countries. 4 days later, on August 26th, he ordered his envoys in Brussels and The Hague to inform the respective governments that in the event of an outbreak of war, Germany will in no circumstances impair the inviolability of Belgium and Holland, an assurance which he repeated publicly on October 6th, after the conclusion of the Polish campaign. The very next day, October 7th, General von Brauchitsch advised his army group commanders, at Hitler's prompting, to make all preparations for immediate invasion of Dutch and Belgian territory, if the political situation so demands. 2 days later, on October 9th, in Directive No. 6, Hitler ordered, "Preparations are to be made for an attacking operation through Luxembourg, Belgium, and Holland. This attack must be carried out as soon and as forcefully as possible. The object of this attack is to acquire as great an area of Holland, Belgium, and northern France as possible." The Belgians and Dutch, of course, were not privy to Hitler's secret orders. Nevertheless, they did receive warnings of what was in store for them. A number of them have already been noted. Colonel Oster, one of the anti-Nazi conspirators, warned the Dutch and Belgian military attachés in Berlin on November 5th to expect the German attack on November 12th, which was then the target date. At the end of October, Gerdler, another one of the conspirators, had gone to Brussels at the instigation of Weizsäcker to warn the Belgians of an imminent attack. And shortly after the new year, on January 10th, 1940, Hitler's plans for the offensive in the West had fallen into the hands of the Belgians when an officer carrying them had made a forced landing in Belgium. By that time, the Dutch and Belgian general staffs knew from their own border intelligence that the Germans were concentrating some 50 divisions on their frontiers. They also had the benefit of an unusual source of information in the German capital. This source was Colonel G. J. Sass, the Netherlands military attaché in Berlin. Sass was a close personal friend of Colonel Oster and often dined with him at the latter's home in the secluded suburb of Zehlendorf, a practice facilitated, once the war broke out, by the blackout, whose cover enabled a number of persons in Berlin at that time, German and foreign, to get about on various subversive missions without much fear of detection. It was Sass whom Oster tipped off early in November about the German onslaught then set for November 12th, and he gave the attaché a new warning in January. The fact that neither attack came off somewhat lessened the credibility of Sass in The Hague and in Brussels, where the fact that Hitler had actually set dates for his aggression and then postponed them naturally was not known. However, the 10 days' warning that Sass got through Oster of the invasion of Norway and Denmark, and his prediction of the exact date, seems to have restored his prestige at home. On May 3rd, Oster told Saas flatly that the German attack in the west through the Netherlands and Belgium would begin on May 10th, and the military attaché promptly informed his government. The next day, The Hague received confirmation of this from its envoy at the Vatican. The Dutch immediately passed the word along to the Belgians. May 5th was a Sunday, and as the week began to unfold, it became pretty obvious to all of us in Berlin that the blow in the west would fall within a few days. Tension mounted in the capital. By May 8th, I was cabling my New York office to hold one of our correspondents in Amsterdam instead of shipping him off to Norway, where the war had ended anyway. And that evening, the military censors allowed me to hint in my broadcast that there would soon be action in the West, including Holland and Belgium. On the evening of May 9th, Oster and Saas dined together for what would prove the last time. The German officer confirmed that the final order had been given to launch the attack in the West at dawn the next day. Just to make sure that there were no last-minute changes, Oster dropped by OKW headquarters in the Bendlerstrasse after dinner. There had been no changes. "The swine has gone to the Western Front," Oster told Saas. The swine was Hitler. Saas informed the Belgian military attaché and then went to his own legation and put through a call to The Hague. A special code for this moment already had been arranged, and Saas spoke some seemingly innocuous words which conveyed the message, "Tomorrow at dawn. Hold tight." Strangely enough, the two big powers in the West, Britain and France, were caught napping. Their general staffs discounted the alarming reports from Brussels and The Hague. London itself was preoccupied with a three-day cabinet crisis, which was resolved only on the evening of May 10th by the replacement of Chamberlain by Churchill as Prime Minister. The first the French and British headquarters heard of the German onslaught was when the peace of the spring pre-dawn was broken by the roar of German bombers and the screech of Stuka dive bombers overhead, followed shortly afterward, as daylight broke, by frantic appeals for help from the Dutch and Belgian governments, which had held the Allies at arm's length for 8 months instead of concerting with them for a common defense. Nevertheless, the Allied plan to meet the main German attack in Belgium went ahead for the first couple of days almost without a hitch. A great Anglo-French army rushed northeastward from the Franco-Belgian border to man the main Belgian defense line along the Diel and Meuse rivers east of Brussels. As it happened, this was just what the German high command wanted. This massive Allied wheeling movement played directly into its hands. Though they did not know it, the Anglo-French armies sped directly into a trap that, when sprung, would soon prove to be utterly disastrous. The rival plans. The original German plan of attack in the West had been drastically changed since it fell into the hands of the Belgians, and, as the Germans suspected, of the French and British in January. Fall Gelb, Case Yellow, as the operation was called, had been hastily concocted in the fall of 1939 by the Army High Command under the pressure of Hitler's order to launch the offensive in the West by mid-November. There is much dispute among military historians and indeed among the German generals themselves whether this first plan was a modified version of the old Schlieffen plan or not. Holder and Guderian have maintained that it was. It called for the main German drive on the right flank through Belgium and northern France, with the object of occupying the Channel ports. It fell short of the famous Schlieffen plan, which had failed by an ace of success in 1914, and which provided not only for the capture of the Channel ports, but for a continuation of a great wheeling movement, which would bring the German right-wing armies through Belgium and northern France and across the Seine, after which they would turn east below Paris and encircle and destroy the remaining French forces. Its purpose had been to quickly put an end to armed French resistance, so that Germany in 1914 could then turn on Russia with the great bulk of its military might. But in 1939-40, Hitler did not have to worry about a Russian front. Nevertheless, his objective was more limited. In the first phase of the campaign, at any rate, he planned not to knock out the French army, but to roll it back and occupy the Channel coast, thus cutting off Britain from its ally and at the same time securing air and naval bases from which he could harass and blockade the British Isles. It is obvious from his various harangues to the generals at this time that he thought that after such a defeat, Britain and France would be inclined to make peace and leave him free to turn his attention once more to the east. Even before the original plan for Fall Gelb had fallen into the hands of the enemy, it was anticipated by the Allied Supreme Command. On November 17th, the Allied Supreme War Council, meeting in Paris, had adopted Plan D, which, in the event of a German attack through Belgium, called for the French 1st and 9th Armies and the British Expeditionary Force to dash forward to the principal Belgian defense line on the Diel and Meuse rivers from Antwerp through Louvain, Namur, and Givet to Mézières. A few days before, the French and British general staffs, in a series of secret meetings with the Belgian High Command, had received the latter's assurance that it would strengthen the defenses on that line and make its main stand there. But the Belgians, still clinging to the illusions of neutrality which fortified their hope that they yet might be spared involvement in war, would not go further. The British chiefs of staff argued that there would not be time to deploy the Allied forces so far forward once the Germans had attacked, but they went along with Plan D at the urging of General Gamelin. At the end of November, the Allies added a scheme to rush General Henri Giraud's 7th Army up the Channel coast to help the Dutch north of Antwerp in case the Netherlands was also attacked. Thus, a German attempt to sweep through Belgium and perhaps Holland to flank the Maginot Line would be met very early in the game by the entire BEF, the bulk of the French Army, the 22 divisions of the Belgians, and the 10 divisions of the Dutch, a force numerically equal, as it turned out, to that of the Germans. It was to avoid such a head-on clash and at the same time to trap the British and French armies that would speed forward so far that General Erich von Manstein, born Lewinsky, chief of staff of Rundstedt's Army Group A on the Western Front, proposed a radical change in Fall Gelb. Manstein was a gifted and imaginative staff officer of relatively junior rank, but during the winter he succeeded in getting his bold idea put before Hitler over the initial opposition of Brauchitsch, Halder, and a number of other generals. Manstein's proposal was that the main German assault should be launched in the center through the Ardennes, with a massive armored force which would then cross the Meuse just north of Sedan and break out into the open country and race to the channel at Abbeville. Hitler, always attracted by daring and even reckless solutions, was interested. Rundstedt pushed the idea relentlessly, not only because he believed in it, but because it would give his Army Group A the decisive role in the offensive. Although Halder's personal dislike of Manstein and certain professional jealousies among some of the generals who outranked him led to Manstein's transfer from his staff post to the command of an infantry corps at the end of January, he had an opportunity to expound his unorthodox views to Hitler personally at a dinner given for a number of new corps commanders in Berlin on February 17th. He argued that an armored strike through the Ardennes would hit the Allies where they least expected it, since their generals probably, like most of the Germans, considered this hilly, wooded country unsuitable for tanks. A feint by the right wing of the German forces would bring the British and French armies rushing pell-mell into Belgium. Then, by cracking through the French at Sedan and heading west along the north bank of the Somme for the Channel, the Germans would entrap the major Anglo-French forces as well as the Belgian army. It was a daring plan, not without its risks, as several generals, including Jodl, emphasized. But by now, Hitler, who considered himself a military genius, practically believed that it was his own idea, and his enthusiasm for it mounted. Halder, who had at first dismissed it as a crackpot idea, also began to embrace it, and indeed, with the help of his general staff officers, considerably improved it. On February 24, 1940, it was formally adopted in a new OKW directive, and the generals were told to redeploy their troops by March 7th. Somewhere along the line, incidentally, the plan for the conquest of the Netherlands, which had been dropped from Fall Gelb in a revision on October 29th, 1939, was reinstated on November 14th at the urging of the Luftwaffe, which wanted the Dutch airfields for use against Britain and which offered to supply a large batch of airborne troops for this minor but somewhat complicated operation. On such considerations are the fates of little nations sometimes decided. And so, as the campaign in Norway approached its victorious conclusion, and the first warm days of the beginning of May arrived, the Germans, with the most powerful army the world had ever seen up to that moment, stood poised to strike in the west. In mere numbers, the two sides were evenly matched. 136 German divisions against 135 divisions of the French, British, Belgian, and Dutch. The defenders had the advantage of vast defensive fortifications, the impenetrable Maginot Line in the south, the extensive line of Belgian forts in the middle, and fortified water lines in Holland in the north. even in the number of tanks the Allies matched the Germans. But they had not concentrated them as had the latter, and because of the aberration of the Dutch and Belgians for neutrality, there had been no staff consultations by which the defenders could pool their plans and resources to the best advantage. The Germans had a unified command, the initiative of the attacker, no moral scruples against aggression, a contagious confidence in themselves, and a daring plan. They had had experience in battle in Poland. There they had tested their new tactics and their new weapons in combat. They knew the value of the dive bomber and the mass use of tanks, and they knew, as Hitler had never ceased to point out, that the French, though they would be defending their own soil, had no heart in what lay ahead. Notwithstanding their confidence and determination, the German High Command, as the secret records make clear, suffered some moments of panic as the 0 hour drew near, or at least Hitler, the Supreme Commander, did. General Jodl jotted them down in his diary. Hitler ordered several last-minute postponements of the jump-off, which on May 1st he had set for May 5th. On May 3rd he put it off until May 6th on account of the weather, but perhaps also in part because the Foreign Office didn't think his proposed justification for violating the neutrality of Belgium and Holland was good enough. The next day he set May 7th as X Day, and on the following day postponed it again until Wednesday, May 8th. Führer has finished justification for Case Yellow, Jodl noted. Belgium and the Netherlands were to be accused of having acted most unneutrally. May 7th. Führer railroad train was scheduled to leave Finkenkrug at 16:38 hours, Jodl's diary continued. But weather remains uncertain, and therefore the order, for the attack, is rescinded. Führer greatly agitated about new postponement, as there is danger of treachery. Talk of the Belgian envoy to the Vatican with Brussels permits the deduction that treason has been committed by a German personality who left Berlin for Rome on April 29th. May 8th. Alarming news from Holland. Cancelling of furloughs, evacuations, roadblocks, other mobilization methods. Führer does not want to wait any longer. Göring wants postponement until the 10th at least. Führer is very agitated. Then he consents to postponement until May 10th, which he says is against his intuition. But not one day longer. May 9th. Führer decides on attack for May 10th for sure. Departure with Führer train at 1700 hours from Finkenkrug. After report that weather situation will be favorable on the 10th, the code word Danzig is given at 2100 hours. Hitler, accompanied by Keitel, Jodl, and others of the OKW staff, arrived at headquarters, which he had named Felsenest, Erie, near Münstereifel, just as dawn was breaking on May 10th. 25 miles to the west, German forces were hurtling over the Belgian frontier. Along a front of 175 miles, from the North Sea to the Maginot Line, Nazi troops broke across the borders of three small neutral states, Holland, Belgium, and Luxembourg, in brutal violation of the German word, solemnly and repeatedly given. The 6 Weeks' War, May 10th to June 25th, 1940. For the Dutch it was a 5-day war, and indeed in that brief period the fate of Belgium, France, and the British Expeditionary Force was sealed. For the Germans, everything went according to the book, or even better than the book, in the unfolding both of strategy and of tactics. Their success exceeded the fondest hopes of Hitler. His generals were confounded by the lightning rapidity and the extent of their own victories. As for the Allied leaders, they were quickly paralyzed by developments they had not faintly expected, and could not, in the utter confusion that ensued, comprehend. Winston Churchill himself, who had taken over as Prime Minister on the first day of battle, was dumbfounded. He was awakened at 7:30 on the morning of May 15th by a telephone call from Premier Paul Reynaud in Paris, who told him in an excited voice, "We have been defeated. We are beaten." Churchill refused to believe it. The great French army vanquished in a week? It was impossible. "I did not comprehend," he wrote later, "the violence of the revolution effected since the last war by the incursion of a mass of fast-moving armor." Tanks, 7 divisions of them concentrated at one point, the weakest position in the Western defenses for the big breakthrough. That was what did it. That and the Stuka dive bombers and the parachutists and the airborne troops, who landed far behind the Allied lines or on top of their seemingly impregnable forts and wrought havoc. And yet we who were in Berlin wondered why these German tactics should have come as such a shattering surprise to the Allied leaders. Had not Hitler's troops demonstrated their effectiveness in the campaign against Poland? There, the great breakthroughs which had surrounded or destroyed the Polish armies within a week had been achieved by the massing of armor after the Stukas had softened up resistance. Parachutists and airborne troops had not done well in Poland, even on the very limited scale with which they were used. They had failed to capture intact the key bridges. But in Norway, a month before the onslaught in the west, they had been prodigious, capturing Oslo and all the airfields, and reinforcing the isolated small groups that had been landed by sea at Stavanger, Bergen, Trondheim, and Narvik, and thereby enabling them to hold out. Hadn't the Allied commanders studied these campaigns and learned their lessons? The conquest of the Netherlands. Only one division of panzers could be spared by the Germans for the conquest of the Netherlands, which was accomplished in 5 days, largely by parachutists and by troops landed by air transports behind the great flooded water lines, which many in Berlin had believed would hold the Germans up for weeks. To the bewildered Dutch was reserved the experience of being subjected to the first large-scale airborne attack in the history of warfare. Considering their unpreparedness for such an ordeal and the complete surprise by which they were taken, they did better than was realized at the time. The first objective of the Germans was to land a strong force by air on the flying fields near The Hague, occupy the capital at once, and capture the Queen and the government, as they had tried to do just a month before with the Norwegians. But at The Hague, as at Oslo, the plan failed, though due to different circumstances. Recovering from their initial surprise and confusion, Dutch infantry, supported by artillery, was able to drive the Germans, 2 regiments strong, from the 3 airfields surrounding The Hague by the evening of May 10th. This saved the capital and the government momentarily, but it tied down the Dutch reserves, which were desperately needed elsewhere. The key to the German plan was the seizure by airborne troops of the bridges just south of Rotterdam over the Nieuwe Maas, and those farther southeast over the 2 estuaries of the Maas, Meuse, at Dordrecht and Moerdijk. It was over these bridges that General Georg von Kukler's 18th Army, driving from the German border nearly 100 miles away, hoped to force his way into Fortress Holland. In no other way could this entrenched place, lying behind formidable water barriers and comprising The Hague, Amsterdam, Utrecht, Rotterdam, and Leiden, be taken easily and quickly. The bridges were seized on the morning of May 10th by airborne units, including 1 company that landed on the river at Rotterdam in antiquated seaplanes, before the surprised Dutch guards could blow them. Desperate efforts were made by improvised Netherlands units to drive the Germans away, and they almost succeeded. But the Germans hung on tenuously until the morning of May 12th, when the 1 armored division assigned to Kukler arrived, having smashed through the Grebbepeil line, a fortified front to the east strengthened by a number of water barriers, on which the Dutch had hoped to hold out for several days. There was some hope that the Germans might be stopped short of the Moerdijk bridges by General Giraud's French 7th Army, which had raced up from the Channel and reached Tilburg on the afternoon of May 11th. But the French, like the hard-pressed Dutch, lacked air support, armor, and anti-tank and anti-aircraft guns, and were easily pushed back to Breda. This opened the way for the German 9th Panzer Division to cross the bridges at Moerdijk and Dordrecht, and on the afternoon of May 12th, arrive at the south bank of the Nieuwe Maas, across from Rotterdam, where the German airborne troops still held the bridges. But the tanks could not get across the Rotterdam bridges. The Dutch, in the meantime, had sealed them off at the northern ends. By the morning of May 14th, then, the situation for the Netherlands was desperate but not hopeless. Fortress Holland had not been cracked. The strong German airborne forces around The Hague had been either captured or dispersed into nearby villages. Rotterdam still held. The German high command, anxious to pull the armored division and supporting troops out of Holland, to exploit a new opportunity which had just been opened to the south in France, was not happy. Indeed, on the morning of the 14th, Hitler issued Directive No. 11, stating, The power of resistance of the Dutch army has proved to be stronger than was anticipated. Political as well as military considerations require that this resistance be broken speedily. How? He commanded that detachments of the Air Force be taken from the 6th Army front in Belgium to facilitate the rapid conquest of Fortress Holland. Specifically, he and Goering ordered a heavy bombing of Rotterdam. The Dutch would be induced to surrender by a dose of Nazi terror, the kind that had been applied the autumn before at beleaguered Warsaw. On the morning of May 14th, a German staff officer from the 39th Corps had crossed the bridge at Rotterdam under a white flag and demanded the surrender of the city. He warned that unless it capitulated, it would be bombed. While surrender negotiations were underway, a Dutch officer had come to German headquarters near the bridge to discuss the details and was returning with the German terms. Bombers appeared and wiped out the heart of the great city. Some 800 persons, almost entirely civilians, were massacred, several thousand wounded, and 78,000 made homeless. It was first reported and long believed that from 25 to 30,000 Dutch were killed, and this is the figure given in the 1953 edition of the Encyclopaedia Britannica. However, at Nuremberg, the Dutch government gave the figure as 814 killed. This bit of treachery, this act of calculated ruthlessness, would long be remembered by the Dutch, though at Nuremberg both Goering and Kesselring of the Luftwaffe defended it, on the grounds that Rotterdam was not an open city but stoutly defended by the Dutch. Both denied that they knew that surrender negotiations were going on when they dispatched the bombers, though there is strong evidence from German army archives that they did. There were no criminal convictions at Nuremberg for the bombing of Rotterdam. At any rate, OKW made no excuses at the time. I myself heard over the Berlin radio on the evening of May 14th a special OKW communique. Under the tremendous impression of the attacks of German dive bombers and the imminent attack of German tanks, the city of Rotterdam has capitulated and thus saved itself from destruction. Rotterdam surrendered, and then the Dutch armed forces. Queen Wilhelmina and the government members had fled to London on two British destroyers. At dusk on May 14th, General H.G. Winckelmann, the commander-in-chief of the Dutch forces, ordered his troops to lay down their arms, and at 11 a.m. on the next day he signed the official capitulation. Within 5 days it was all over. The fighting, that is. For 5 years, a night of savage German terror would henceforth darken this raped, civilized little land. The fall of Belgium and the trapping of the Anglo-French armies. By the time the Dutch had surrendered, the die was cast for Belgium, France, and the British Expeditionary Force. May 14th, though it was only the 5th day of the attack, was the fatal day. The previous evening, German armor had secured 4 bridgeheads across the steeply banked and heavily wooded Meuse River from Dinant to Sedan, captured the latter city, which had been the scene of Napoleon III's surrender to Moltke in 1870 and the end of the Third Empire, and gravely threatened the center of the Allied lines and the hinge on which the flower of the British and French armies had so quickly wheeled into Belgium. The next day, May 14th, the avalanche broke. An army of tanks unprecedented in warfare for size, concentration, mobility, and striking power, which, when it had started through the Ardennes forest from the German frontier on May 10th, stretched in 3 columns back for 100 miles far behind the Rhine, broke through the French 9th and 2nd armies and headed swiftly for the Channel, behind the Allied forces in Belgium. This was a formidable and frightening juggernaut, preceded by waves of Stuka dive bombers, which softened up the French defensive positions, swarming with combat engineers who launched rubber boats and threw up pontoon bridges to get across the rivers and canals, each panzer division possessed of its own self-propelled artillery and of 1 brigade of motorized infantry, and the armored corps, closely followed by divisions of motorized infantry to hold the positions opened up by the tanks. This phalanx of steel and fire could not be stopped by any means in the hands of the bewildered defenders. On both sides of Dinant on the Meuse, the French gave way to General Hermann Hoth's 15th Armored Corps, one of whose 2 tank divisions was commanded by a daring young brigadier general, Erwin Rommel. Farther south along the river at Montermé, the same pattern was being executed by General Georg Hans Reinhardt's 41st Armored Corps of two tank divisions. But it was around Sedan, of disastrous memory to the French, that the greatest blow fell. Here, on the morning of May 14th, two tank divisions of General Heinz Guderian's 19th Armored Corps poured across a hastily constructed pontoon bridge set up during the night over the Meuse and struck toward the west. The two armored corps of Reinhardt and Guderian made up General Ewald von Kleist's Panzer Group, which consisted of five tank divisions and three motorized infantry divisions. Though French armor and British bombers tried desperately to destroy the bridge, 40 of 71 RAF planes were shot down in one single attack, mostly by flak, and 70 French tanks were destroyed. They could not damage it. By evening, the German bridgehead at Sedan was 30 miles wide and 15 miles deep, and the French forces in the vital center of the Allied line were shattered. Those who were not surrounded and made prisoners were in disorderly retreat. The Franco-British armies to the north, as well as the 22 divisions of Belgians, were placed in dire danger of being cut off. The first couple of days had gone fairly well for the Allies, or so they thought. To Churchill, plunging with new zest into his fresh responsibilities as Prime Minister, up until the night of the 12th, as he later wrote, there was no reason to suppose that the operations were not going well. Gamelin, the generalissimo of the Allied forces, was highly pleased with the situation. The evening before, the best and largest part of the French forces, the 1st, 7th, and 9th Armies, along with the BEF, nine divisions strong under Lord Gort, had joined the Belgians as planned on a strong defensive line running along the Deal River from Antwerp through Louvain to Wavre, and thence across the Jean Blue Gap to Namur and south along the Meuse to Sedan. Between the formidable Belgian fortress of Namur and Antwerp, on a front of only 60 miles, the Allies actually outnumbered the oncoming Germans, having some 36 divisions against the 20 in Reichenau's 6th Army. The Belgians, though they had fought well along the reaches of their northeast frontier, had not held out there as long as had been expected, certainly not as long as in 1914. They, like the Dutch to the north of them, had simply not been able to cope with the revolutionary new tactics of the Wehrmacht. Here, as in Holland, the Germans seized the vital bridges by the daring use of a handful of specially trained troops landed silently at dawn in gliders. They overpowered the guards at two of the three bridges over the Albert Canal behind Maastricht before the defenders could throw the switches that were supposed to blow them. They had even greater success in capturing Fort Ebenemal, which commanded the junction of the Meuse River and the Albert Canal. This modern, strategically located fortress was regarded by both the Allies and the Germans as the most impregnable fortification in Europe, stronger than anything the French had built in the Maginot Line or the Germans in the West Wall. Constructed in a series of steel and concrete galleries deep underground, its gun turrets protected by heavy armor and manned by 1,200 men, it was expected to hold out indefinitely against the pounding of the heaviest bombs and artillery shells. It fell in 30 hours to 80 German soldiers who, under the command of a sergeant, had landed in 9 gliders on its roof, and whose total casualties amounted to 6 killed and 19 wounded. In Berlin, I remember, OKW made the enterprise look very mysterious, announcing in a special communique on the evening of May 11th that Fort Ebenemal had been taken by a new method of attack, an announcement that caused rumors to spread, and Dr. Goebbels was delighted to fan them, that the Germans had a deadly new secret weapon, perhaps a nerve gas that temporarily paralyzed the defenders. The truth was much more prosaic. With their usual flair for minute preparation, the Germans during the winter of 1939-40 had erected at Hildesheim a replica of the fort and of the bridges across the Albert Canal, and had trained some 400 glider troops on how to take them. Three groups were to capture the three bridges, the fourth, Ebenemal. This last unit of 80 men landed on the top of the fortress and placed a specially prepared hollow explosive in the armored gun turrets, which not only put them out of action, but spread flames and gas in the chambers below. Portable flamethrowers were also used at the gun portals and observation openings. Within an hour, the Germans were able to penetrate the upper galleries, render the light and heavy guns of the great fort useless, and blind its observation posts. Belgian infantry behind the fortification tried vainly to dislodge the tiny band of attackers, but they were driven off by Stuka attacks and by reinforcements of parachutists. By the morning of May 11th, advanced panzer units, which had raced over the two intact bridges to the north, arrived at the fort and surrounded it, and after further Stuka bombings and hand-to-hand fighting in the underground tunnels, a white flag was hoisted at noon, and the 1,200 dazed Belgian defenders filed out and surrendered. This feat, along with the capture of the bridges and the violence of the attack mounted by General von Reichenau's 6th Army, which was sustained by General Hübner's 16th Armored Corps of 2 tank divisions and 1 mechanized infantry division, convinced the Allied High Command that now, as in 1914, the brunt of the German offensive was being carried out by the enemy's right wing, and that they had taken the proper means to stop it. In fact, as late as the evening of May 15th, the Belgian, British, and French forces were holding firm on the Diehl line from Antwerp to Namur. This was just what the German High Command wanted. It had now become possible for it to spring the Manstein plan and deliver the haymaker in the center. General Halder, the chief of the Army General Staff, saw the situation and his opportunities very clearly on the evening of May 13th. "North of Namur," he wrote in his diary, "we can count on a completed concentration of some 24 British and French and about 15 Belgian divisions. Against this, our 6th Army has 15 divisions on the front and 6 in reserve. We are strong enough there to fend off any enemy attack. No need to bring up any more forces. South of Namur, we face a weaker enemy, about half our strength. Outcome of Meuse attack will decide if, when, and where we will be able to exploit this superiority. The enemy has no force worth mentioning behind this front." No force worth mentioning behind this front, which the next day was broken? On May 16th, Prime Minister Churchill flew to Paris to find out. By the afternoon, when he drove to the Quai d'Orsay to see Premier Reynaud and General Gamelin, German spearheads were 60 miles west of Sedan, rolling along the undefended open country. Nothing very much stood between them and Paris, or between them and the Channel, but Churchill did not know this. "Where is the strategic reserve?" he asked Gamelin, and breaking into French, "Où est la masse de manœuvre?" The commander-in-chief of the Allied armies turned to him with a shake of the head and a shrug and answered, "Aucune. There is none." After the war, Gamelin stated that his reply was not, "There is none," but "There is no longer any." L'Aurore, Paris, November 21, 1949. "I was dumbfounded," Churchill later related. "It was unheard of that a great army, when attacked, held no troops in reserve." "I admit," says Churchill, "that this was one of the greatest surprises I have had in my life." It was scarcely less a surprise to the German High Command, or at least to Hitler and the generals at OKW, if not to Halder. Twice during this campaign in the West, which the Führer himself directed, he hesitated. The first occasion was on May 17th, when a crisis of nerves overcame him. That morning, Guderian, who was a third of the way to the Channel with his Panzer Corps, received an order to halt in his tracks. Intelligence had been received from the Luftwaffe that the French were mounting a great counterattack to cut off the thin, armored German wedges which extended westward from Sedan. Hitler conferred hastily with his army commander-in-chief, Brauchitsch, and with Halder. He was certain that a serious French threat was developing from the south. Rundstedt, commander of Army Group A, the main force which had launched the breakthrough over the Meuse, backed him up when they conferred later in the day. He expected, he said, a great surprise counteroffensive by strong French forces from the Verdun and Chalon-sur-Marne areas. The specter of a second Marne rose in Hitler's feverish mind. "I am keeping an eye on this," he wrote Mussolini the next day. "The miracle of the Marne of 1914 will not be repeated." "A very unpleasant day," Halder noted in his diary the evening of May 17th. "The Führer is terribly nervous. He is worried over his own success, will risk nothing, and insists on restraining us. Puts forward the excuse that it is all because of his concern with the left flank. He has brought only bewilderment and doubts." The Nazi warlord showed no improvement during the next day, despite the avalanche of news about the French collapse. Halder recorded the crisis in his diary of the 18th. "The Führer has an unaccountable worry about the south flank. He rages and screams that we are on the way to ruining the whole operation, and that we are courting the danger of a defeat. He won't have any part in continuing the drive westward, let alone southwest, and clings always to the idea of a thrust to the northwest. This is the subject of a most unpleasant dispute between the Führer on the one side and Brauchitsch and me on the other. General Jodl of OKW, for whom the Führer was nearly always right, also noted the discord at the top. "Day of great tension," he wrote on the 18th. "The commander-in-chief of the army, Brauchitsch, has not carried out the intention of building up as quickly as possible a new flanking position to the south. Brauchitsch and Halder are called immediately and ordered peremptorily to adopt the necessary measures immediately." But Halder had been right. The French had no forces with which to stage a counterattack from the south. And though the panzer divisions, chafing at the bit as they were, received orders to do no more than proceed with a reconnaissance in force, this was all they needed to press toward the channel. By the morning of May 19th, a mighty wedge of 7 armored divisions, driving relentlessly westward north of the Somme River past the storied scenes of battle of the First World War, was only some 50 miles from the channel. On the evening of May 20th, to the surprise of Hitler's headquarters, the 2nd Panzer Division reached Abbeville at the mouth of the Somme. The Belgians, the BEF, and the 3 French armies were trapped. "Führer is beside himself with joy," Jodl scribbled in his diary that night. "Talks in words of highest appreciation of the German army and its leadership. Is working on the peace treaty, which shall express the tenor, return of territory robbed over the last 400 years from the German people, and of other values. A special memorandum is in the files containing the emotion-choked words of the Führer when receiving the telephone report from the commander-in-chief of the army about the capture of Abbeville." The only hope of the Allies to extricate themselves from this disastrous encirclement was for the armies in Belgium to immediately turn southwest, disengage themselves from the German 6th Army attacking them there, fight their way across the German armored wedge that stretched across northern France to the sea, and join up with fresh French forces pushing northward from the Somme. This was in fact what General Gamelin ordered on the morning of May 19th, but he was replaced that evening by General Maxime Weygand, who immediately cancelled the order. Weygand, who had a formidable military reputation gained in the First World War, wanted to confer first with the Allied commanders in Belgium before deciding what to do. As a result, 3 days were lost before Weygand came up with precisely the same plan as his predecessor. The delay proved costly. There were still 40 French, British, and Belgian battle-tested divisions in the north, and had they struck south across the thin armored German line on May 19th, as Gamelin ordered, they might have succeeded in breaking through. By the time they moved, communications between the various national commands had become chaotic, and the several Allied armies, hard-pressed as they were, began to act at cross-purposes. At any rate, the Weygand plan existed only in the general's mind. No French troops ever moved up from the Somme. In the meantime, the German High Command had thrown in all the infantry troops that could be rushed up to strengthen the armored gap and enlarge it. By May 24th, Guderian's tanks, driving up the channel from Abbeville, had captured Boulogne and surrounded Calais, the 2 main ports, and reached Gravelines, some 20 miles down the coast from Dunkirk. The front in Belgium had moved southwestward as the Allies attempted to detach themselves there. By the 24th, then, the British, French, and Belgian armies in the north were compressed into a relatively small triangle, with its base along the channel from Gravelines to Tournaison, and its apex at Valenciennes, some 70 miles inland. There was now no hope of breaking out of the trap. The only hope, and it seemed a slim one, was possible evacuation by sea from Dunkirk. It was at this juncture, on May 24th, that the German armor, now within sight of Dunkirk and poised along the Ahr Canal between Gravelines and Saint-Omer for the final kill, received a strange, and to the soldiers in the field inexplicable, order to halt their advance. It was the first of the German High Command's major mistakes in World War II, and became a subject of violent controversy, not only between the German generals themselves, but among the military historians, as to who was responsible and why. We shall return to that question in a moment in the light of a mass of material now available. Whatever the reasons for this stop order, it provided a miraculous reprieve to the Allies, and especially to the British, leading as it did to the miracle of Dunkirk. But it did not save the Belgians. The capitulation of King Leopold. King Leopold III of the Belgians surrendered early on the morning of May 28th. The headstrong young ruler, who had taken his country out of its alliance with France and Britain into a foolish neutrality, who had refused to restore the alliance even during the months when he knew the Germans were preparing a massive assault across his border, who at the last moment, after Hitler had struck, called on the French and British for military succor and received it, now deserted them in a desperate hour, opening the dike for German divisions to pour through on the flank of the sorely pressed Anglo-French troops. Moreover, he did it, as Churchill told the Commons on June 4th, without prior consultation, with the least possible notice, without the advice of his ministers, and upon his own personal act. Actually, he did it against the unanimous advice of his government, which he was constitutionally sworn to follow. At 5 a.m. on May 25th, there was a showdown meeting at the King's headquarters between the monarch and three members of the cabinet, including the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister. They urged him for the last time not to surrender personally and become a prisoner of the Germans, for if he did, he would be degraded to the role of Hacke in Prague. They also reminded him that he was head of state as well as commander-in-chief, and that if matters came to the worst, he could exercise his first office in exile, as the Queen of Holland and the King of Norway had decided to do, until eventual Allied victory came. "I have decided to stay," Leopold answered. "The cause of the Allies is lost." At 5 p.m. on May 27th, he dispatched General de Rousseau, deputy chief of the Belgian General Staff, to the Germans to ask for a truce. At 10 o'clock, the general brought back the German terms. "The Führer demands that arms be laid down unconditionally." The king accepted unconditional surrender at 11 p.m. and proposed that fighting cease at 4 a.m., which it did. Leopold's capitulation was angrily denounced by Premier Reynaud of France in a violent broadcast, and Belgian Premier Pierlot, also broadcasting from Paris but in a more dignified tone, informed the Belgian people that the king had acted against the unanimous advice of the government, broken his links with the people, and was no longer in a position to govern, and that the Belgian government in exile would continue the struggle. Churchill, when he spoke in the House on May 28th, reserved judgment on Leopold's action, but on June 4th joined in the general criticism. The controversy raged long after the war was over. Leopold's defenders, and there were many in and outside Belgium, believed that he had done the right and honorable thing in sharing the fate of his soldiers and of the Belgian people. And they made much of the claim that the king acted not as chief of state, but as commander-in-chief of the Belgian army in surrendering. That the battered Belgian troops were in desperate straits by May 27th, there is no dispute. Valiantly, they had agreed to extend their front in order to free the British and French to fight their way south, and that extended front was fast collapsing, though the Belgians fought doggedly. Also, Leopold was not told that on May 26th, Lord Gort had received orders from London to withdraw to Dunkirk and save what he could of the BEF. That is one side of the argument, but there is another. The Belgian army was under the overall Allied command, and Leopold made a separate peace without consulting it. In his defense, it has been pointed out that on May 27th at 12:30 p.m., he telegraphed Gort that he soon would be forced to capitulate to avoid a collapse. But the British commander, who was extremely busy and constantly on the move, did not receive it. He later testified that he first heard of the surrender only shortly after 11 p.m. on May 27th and found himself suddenly faced with an open gap of 20 miles between Ypres and the sea through which enemy armored forces might reach the beaches. To General Weygand, who was the king's superior military commander, the news arrived by telegram from French liaison at Belgian headquarters a little after 6 p.m., and it hit him, he later said, like a bolt out of the blue. There had been no warning. Finally, even as commander-in-chief of the armed forces, Leopold, in this constitutional democratic monarchy, was bound to accept the advice of his government. Neither in that role, nor certainly as chief of state, did he have the authority to surrender on his own. In the end, the Belgian people, as was proper, passed judgment on their sovereign. He was not recalled to the throne from Switzerland, where he took refuge at the war's end, until 5 years after it was over, when the call came on July 20, 1950, after 57% of those voting in a referendum had approved it. His return provoked such a violent reaction among the populace that civil war threatened to break out. He soon abdicated in favor of his son. Whatever may be said of Leopold's behavior, there should be no dispute, though there has been,